This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 6, Episode 14 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today is the second part in our two-part series on James Horner, where we are going to be looking at, primarily, the movie which he won his two Oscars for, Titanic, as well as the rest of his career, which is large and varied.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, leading up to a movie that just came out a couple weeks ago, Southpaw. So we'll get into that too, because I actually did see that a few days back. So we can finish up with that.
Excellent.
But let's start with Titanic. Now, Titanic was a movie that came out in 1997. It was directed by James Cameron, and James Horner wrote the music for it. He had previously worked with Cameron on Aliens 11 years prior, and their relationship was not good, so much so that at least one of them vowed that they would never work with the other one again. I forget which one, but it didn't go well. But I guess, you know, after 10 years, 11 years, with James Cameron making some of the finest films ever in the history of film, and James Horner writing some of the finest scores ever in the history of film, they decided that it was time to get the band back together and make some Titanic.
Yes.
And the movie won 17,000 Oscars.
17,001, technically, because they didn't air one of the technical ones they got.
Okay, all right, I forgot about that one. It was, it made like more money than any other movie ever in history or something like that. And, you know, two of those Oscars were won by James Horner. They also won for Best Picture. I guess that's noteworthy. It's on the AFI's list of the top 100 films of all time. But James Horner, he took home two Oscars that night, one for Best Original Score and one for Best Original Song for My Heart Will Go On. So, Titanic. Now, before we get into James Horner's music in particular, let's talk about the movie itself. What do you think about Titanic?
Well, I think that Titanic deserved all of the success that it got. I don't know if it deserved every Oscar that it received. The hype and the hoopla around it got a little out of control.
Well, let me ask you this. Yes. Where were you at as far as, you know, life or movie viewership or whatever in December of 1997, in terms of James Cameron fandom and all that?
I adored James Cameron up to that point. I loved True Lies. I loved Terminator 2. I loved Aliens. Like, the guy walked on water. Like, if you put James Cameron's name on a movie, you would get me into the theater. Period and end of sentence. And I was a little skeptical about the whole Titanic thing, but I knew that when the ship sank, it was going to look fantastic. So that got me into the theater, hands down. And I saw it very early in its run, because it was like what a lot of people, I think, forget is that it was a slow boil. It was not a huge splash, well, no pun intended, success from the get-go. It wasn't like when, you know, X-Men 2 opens and it makes $150 million in a weekend.
And then the next weekend it has the customary, you know, 40% drop-off or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Titanic made more in its second weekend than it did in its first.
Right. Word of mouth propelled that movie forward. And the fact, a special tip of the hat should go to the movie for being able to appeal across, I guess what you could say were traditional gender lines. Like, repeat viewers traditionally up to that point were regarded as young males with disposable income, were the ones that were going to multiple viewings. But they found with Titanic that it wound up being young females would go to multiple viewings. And I remember very specifically reading an article at the time about a group of girls that the reporter wrote about, that it was like their second or third viewing. It must have been their third. And they were all going in with like a box of tissues. And the contest was to see who cried last in the movie. Because, you know, it pulls at the old heartstrings. It does a really good job of it.
Yeah.
I think it's a really well put together movie. I didn't care for the main plot as much as others did. But all of the stuff around it, I thought, was brilliant. The effects were phenomenal, especially for the time. The performances on the whole were great. I mean, David Warner was in it, and he was fantastic as, you know, the heavy right-hand man of, you know, the quote-unquote bad guy who, you know, wanted to marry Kate Winslet. But, you know, and then you had the framing device of the old lady telling the salvage crew about the story and all of that. Like, it was just a really... It's an engrossing film. For me, the emotionally resonant parts were all about the people in steerage and, you know, the band and the cook and all of those people. Like, that was what really sold me about the movie. But it is a fantastic film. It really is.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, for me, I was 17 years old and, you know, just starting to get into movies, you know, seriously for a couple of years at that point. And, you know, I had discovered James Cameron as well, you know, movies like The Abyss. You know, I had the big box set, the film school in a box, Laserdisc set. And, you know, Aliens was another one which was really high on the list for me. And I had discovered, you know, all of his movies. I had watched them all. I had even, for my junior thesis paper, I wrote... like a 10-page, 15-page paper, whatever it was, on James Cameron. And this was back before anyone that I knew or anyone was talking about, you know, him. I mean, it was just like, I was this huge Cameron fan when sort of no one around me was, which is weird, you know, now, yeah. You know. But because of that, you know, you heard about Titanic and it had been, you know, in the making for a couple years. So, you know, I was very anxiously awaiting this movie because I was too young to see True Lies and not interested in movies when True Lies came out. So I had never experienced Cameron on the big screen, and he was like my number one guy. So then, you know, especially when the first trailer came out. And I don't know if you remember that trailer, but in addition to all of, like, the awesome sweeping shots, you know, there's, like, all the stuff with, like, the boat sinking. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Like, I was right at that point, like where I'm starting to sort of become aware of what's involved with the filmmaking process, you know. And yeah. And the stuff that he was doing in that trailer was so next level for me. You know, I'm just like amazed by the craftsmanship, and I'm like, I can't wait to see this. I had recorded the trailer off of TV, like the E channel. Yeah. They would have their trailer, I think it was, they called it like Trailer Park or whatever.
Yes,
where
they
showed like trailers every week, and I had recorded it, and I just watched that again and again and again. And then it got pushed back because it was supposed to come out 4th of July weekend. Same weekend as Men in Black, which that's always a big what if for me. You know, if it had gone up against Men in Black 4th of July weekend, would it have been nearly as successful as it ended up being?
I will say authoritatively no, not a chance, because everybody goes for the entertaining movie. Like, you're going to put up a what was it, 3.5 hour movie up against Men in Black, which is just nothing but quick jokes.
Yeah,
not a chance.
I mean, it really was perfectly suited to that late December slot, you know, and in that time, my anticipation was just building and building and building. And I mean, I will never forgive them for this, but like, I remember like walking through the mall with my mom. I'm 17, you know, and we're walking through the mall, and there's the poster That very iconic poster where it's like the two of them embracing and then the ship is coming up in between them. And I'm like, look, Mom, look at this. And I'm just staring at the poster just like, oh, my God, this is going to be amazing. And she's like humoring me like, yeah, I will be. Okay. All right. So then I hear a week later that she was out Christmas shopping with my dad and she starts imitating me and making fun of me to him. I'm like, are you kidding me? Come
on. Your mom's awesome. She's awesome.
Yeah, and she did go to see it with me opening night. You know, I mean, that's the thing. Like, leading up to it, I was, you know, like, at high school and everything, I was like, this movie's going to be amazing. Everyone, you know, watch out for this movie. And everyone's like, shut up. No one cares. This is going to suck. It's just a, you know, I mean, they were going through the whole thing. And then, like, when we came back, because it came out the first day of winter break, like, or the last day before winter break. So we come back 2 weeks later, and I'm like, yeah, you guys, you can all kiss my ass, right? Highest, how many times did you see it? Yeah, that's what I thought, right?
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, I was really looking forward to it. And we went to see it, my mom and I, opening night at McClurg Court in Chicago, which was the theater, the THX certified, you know, still my favorite theater of all time.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's where we all lined up for episode one and episode two. It was gone by the time episode three came out. And yeah, it was an amazing experience, I have to say. Like, I mean, the crowd was just so, I mean, everyone rushed into the theater to go see, you know, sold out opening night. And it blew me away. Like, it was the first time. I mean, I had seen, you know, the special editions had come out earlier that year and everything. And that was an amazing experience. And I had seen a few other things. But this is the first time that there was, like, a new movie that came out. And it had that sort of epic scale to it. And it completely blew me away, you know?
Sure.
And I remember, like, I remember coming home that night and going upstairs to my room, and I had my stack of Laserdiscs, like maybe like 50 movies on Laserdisc, and I'm looking through all of them, and I got to the end of the stack, and I'm just like, nope, there's nothing that can possibly compare to what I just experienced. I'm not even going to bother trying to watch a movie now, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that was it blew me away, and it still does. You know, it still holds up for me. It's
no, it totally should. Yeah, absolutely.
But it is crazy. It is one of those things. Cameron was talking about this, I think, when they did the re-release for 3D, where, like, he's like, you know, it was really big with, you know, teen girls and everything, you know, like you were saying. And now all of those teen girls, you know, it's 15 years later or whatever, they're all adults and stuff. And now they've got, you know, husbands and kids and everything, you know. And the people who saw it and loved it back then when they were, you know, like adolescents, they connected to it in that sort of like fantasy fairy tale aspect, you know, that idea of love. And it's like now as you age with the film, you start seeing different sides of it. And now you see, you know, those same people watching it now see it and appreciate like a different kind of love and a different kind of tragedy, you know.
Yeah.
And kind of like what you were talking about with, you know, the idea of protecting your family and everything like that against, you know, this sort of unstoppable force or whatever.
Right.
And yeah. I thought that was really interesting, and I think that it's true. I can see myself doing that, you know, for sure. Because, I mean, while, you know, there were a lot of people who were like, a lot of Cameron fans who were like, yeah, you know, the first hour and a half was boring, but then when the ship was sinking, you know, that was awesome. I just want to fast forward to the end. That I never felt that. Like, I was so into that love story. It wasn't even funny.
See, I think that there very much is a... for lack of a better term, very much a macho impulse that exists, at least in my circle of friends it did, where nobody wanted to admit that first hour and a half is why the second hour and a half matters.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you're not invested in the story by the time everything starts going south, then you're not going to care about the people that are sinking on the ship. You're not going to care about seeing Strauss in the bed with his wife and everything. Like, you really... he immerses you, even though really the main plot is sort of just like Romeo and Juliet retread, in a sense. But like, it still grabs you enough. He did such a good job of reconstructing the era, the world, that while you're in that movie, you actually feel like you're there. You feel, you know, the only way I can say it is you feel authentic. And, you know, being there with everybody, there is a reason why when things start going south, and there wasn't a single person in the movie theater seeing that movie that didn't, especially the first time, that didn't like openly weep.
Yeah.
Like you were just crying buckets by the end. And, you know, I was there the first time I saw it, I was with, I think, with my friend Mike. And because, you know, I wasn't expecting anything quite like it. You know, I was just like, it's a Jim Cameron movie about a sinking boat. OK, you know, like, and I went in and I was skeptical as well. You know, like you mentioned how everybody was like, oh, this is going to suck and everything. Like, as I remember reading Premiere Magazine, which is gone now,
yeah,
talking about the troubles in July when they postponed it.
Yeah.
And they talked about, oh, this is bad news for Cameron. Look at how much money he's spending. He's going to be done if this isn't a success. And so everybody did go into it with a negative thing. And I think that helps the movie back then, because everybody goes in caught completely off guard because they just hear nothing but how it's a troubled production and how it's going over budget and Cameron can't rein it in. And the product you get at the end is just not what you expect from these stories that you've read.
Yeah. Yeah. It is kind of crazy. I mean, like what he did, you know, it would have been impossible. You know, a lot of people criticize him for telling like a fictional story kind of in this, this non-fictional world or whatever. To me, that was like the perfect thing to do, because it allowed him to do two things. One, it allowed him to sort of bring the tragedy, the scale of the tragedy, down to a manageable level, you know, down to a level which the average person could relate to. Because when you start talking about a tragedy of that magnitude, it becomes an abstract concept, you know?
Yeah.
So
you're absolutely right. Yeah.
So what he did was, he's like, here's a story of two people in the midst of this tragedy. Now, after we've made you cry or whatever over the two of them, let's take a step back and apply that. Let's multiply that by, you know, 1,000, and, you know, this is what you get, you know, and it's like that, you know, is very impactful to me anyway. But the other thing that it, you know, for someone like him who's way into the history and the historical accuracy of everything, what it allows him to do is, instead of making something which is completely scattershot and not really conducive to a cohesive narrative, it allows him to basically craft the narrative around the actual events so that he can touch on everything that he wants to touch on historically, and you know, throw everything in there that way.
Coming down on him about the, I remember people at the time saying, "Oh, well, I think she gives the finger at one point," and I remember how petty the criticisms became. In an article, somebody said, "Well, giving the middle finger wasn't really popular with the upper classes at that time," and I was like, "Are you kidding me? Is anybody going back to Raiders of the Lost Ark and critiquing like the hem of the trousers that he's wearing or anything like that?" I mean, it's the same concept. Indiana Jones never existed. However, the Nazis did, and World War II did. And so you know, you can navigate through that. And, you know, you frame, like you said, your fictional story with the real.
Yeah, I know. That's kind of how you know you've made it. I mean, I'm shocked that it still happens today, but, you know, any time a movie, I mean, Avengers, how many articles were there about everything the Avengers got wrong and all of the little mistakes? And you read half of them and you're like, that doesn't even make any sense, you know? That's not true. No, you're just making stuff up now, you know? But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I really do think that Titanic on the whole is a masterpiece. I do think that it's one of the best movies ever made. It's in my top 10 of all time. I think it's James Cameron's best. I love everything about it.
I don't think it's James Cameron's best, but I do respect it and I do love it as anybody should.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, what about Horner's contribution to the movie? Let's talk about the music first. Okay. What do you think about the music?
It's a great soundtrack. It fits. It works. I listened to it a couple of times, you know, just to sort of, you know, revisit it and then bouncing back between other soundtracks and everything. And it works. I think that the score fits. I mean, that's the best thing you can say about a score. Yeah. Is it contributes and it helps move the story along, and it doesn't feel out of place.
Yeah. You know, I got the soundtrack when it came out, you know, because, well, kind of like what John was talking about last week, where you want to relive the movie and, you know, you can't get it instantly or whatever. So one way that you can do that is by listening to the score. And it was one of those things where, like, even when I was watching the movie, I was not necessarily blown away by the score so much. I mean, Horner's, like, style of music just on its own has never really been my jam, you know. I'm much sure. More interested in, like, musically in what, let's say, Goldsmith is doing or Williams or whatever. But I think that there's two sides of it. One is like, well, how good is the music on its own? I mean, you know, I can listen to John Bryant. Like, I've never seen Paranorman, and yet I heard that John Bryan did the music for it. So, you know, I listened to the entire score because I just want to hear what John Bryan is doing. But then the flip side of that is like, well, how well does it work in the movie? You know, because it is music which is written for a movie, and that's right. What matters most. And when it comes to that, I think that Horner is amazing. And Titanic, I really do think, is his masterpiece as well, at least out of the ones that I've heard or seen. I think I was talking about this on Standard Orbit, but, you know, there are some set pieces and everything in that movie which are some of the most amazing sequences in movie history, and the score complements it so well. You know, I mean, it complements the visuals and Cameron's, you know, sort of like visual language and everything is so solid that it just makes sense to have music which complements it, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you pulled out the music, I don't know if it would work as well, but I mean, he just nails it. He knows exactly what Cameron's doing, and he knows exactly mm-hmm. what he needs to do in order to support the visual language of the film, and the result is stunning. I mean, there's two sequences in particular, and they're not, they're all in the first act, you know. It's like the sinking of the ship is amazing, sure, and I'm especially impressed throughout the movie, but in the end in particular, sort of the weaving in and out of like historical music and source music with, you know, mm-hmm. the score and everything, that all works really well. But the two sequences which just blow me away again and again and again are the approaching the ship, like when we're first introduced to Rose in the past.
Yes.
When she, that whole thing where they're she's like getting onto the boat, essentially, right?
Yes.
That's amazing. And then when they're pulling away from the dock and there's the whole, like, I'm the king of the world thing. Yeah. Okay. Like, it's one of those things where I've struggled with this since the first time that I saw it, right? It's like, he does his whole thing where he's like, I'm the king of the world. And there's this urge in me to just be like, shut up, that's stupid. This is the cheesiest crap I've ever seen in my life. And yet, like, that's what my mind is saying, but like my body, like, is having this visceral reaction to what's been building since, like, they started leaving dock, right?
Yeah.
And sort of like the brilliance of the filmmaking and how perfectly the music, you know, reinforces that. And by the time he gets up there and he says, I'm the king of the world, and the music swells, and then it goes to that amazing shot where it starts on one corner in the front of the boat and goes all the way down and comes out the back. I'm just like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life, you know? And the score is perfect, like one of the best pieces of music ever in movie history. So that's my thoughts on that.
So your general impression is that you liked it.
I thought it
was a positive.
It's a pretty good movie, good score. Yeah. But now let's talk about that song.
My
Heart Will Go On. You couldn't get away from it.
You could not.
Especially if you watched VH1 with any regularity. What did you think about the song?
I got sick of it like everybody else did. I mean, come on. There wasn't, like you said, you couldn't escape it. Mm-hmm. It was like, but it's just like any other movie song. The first time you hear it, you're like, oh, this is a beautiful song. And the second time you hear it, you're like, oh, this is pretty cool. And then eventually by the thousandth time you hear it. The same thing happened with Everything I Do It For You with Bryan Adams, which was attached to a horrible movie, but it's a good song. You know, it's a nice ballad and everything. Like that got so overplayed that you were just like, whenever you heard it, you were ready to just throw yourself out the window. And that's the unfortunate thing is My Heart Will Go On is a fantastic song and it's well performed, but if I hear it to this day, my last sense memory impression is like smoking a cigarette and it coming on a friend's radio and me going, turn that off or I swear to God, I'm going to end you. Just end, stop it now. Like they just overplayed the hell out of that thing.
Yeah. I think you're more forgiving of it than I am. Like from the very first moment I heard it, I'm like, oh, what is this? What is this cheesy crap?
You know? Have you no heart? It's a love song. Come on, man.
I have no heart. I mean, like I said, I was in high school at the time. I was a senior in high school, and we were right in the middle of the grunge era. And you know, I'm listening to Garbage and Nirvana and Pearl Jam and not Celine Dion, not in the slightest. I remember like when they had the little like music playing, you know, before the movie starts in the theater.
Yeah.
And Fiona Apple came on because her first album was just coming out, Tidal. And I'm like, oh, this is so great, you know? But I don't know why I remember that, but I do. But, you know, then you get to the end, and there's Celine Dion singing her thing, and I'm just like, oh, my God, this is just embarrassing. Like, I mean, that's more than anything. I'm just like, this is embarrassing because I'm trying to say, like, this is, you know, one of the best movies ever made, and we've just seen this amazing thing. And even the way that the music ends, like, as, you know, they do the whole thing, it fades to black. And then there's a little flute, like a 3 or 4 note flute solo thing that the piece of orchestral music ends with, and it's so perfectly done because it comes up and then fades out along with the written and directed by James Cameron credit. So when his credit it's like you see the whole movie and his credit, it fades out, the music fades out. And then the scroll starts or whatever with My Heart Will Go On. And I'm like, no.
Okay. So, all right. Now, in terms of that, like, I go back. My moment like that is with the 1989 Batman when I think it was Scandalous by Prince started playing over the credits. I was like, no. What? I just watched Batman beat the tar out of everybody, and now you got Scandalous playing? Come on, guys. But the thing is, like, My Heart Will Go On, it's fitting. I won't lie. It was, I have always regarded it as that type of song where, I loved it, but it's the type of song that a lot of us loved, but didn't want to admit that we loved because quite frankly, and this is from the ticker, nobody wanted to sing it to us. And so it was like, you had to hate the song because you're like, nobody's singing it to me. So it sucks, man. It's awful. Nobody's dancing with me.
That was not it for me. I mean, I had all sorts of, hang ups, in high school for sure. that was not one of them. I can honestly say I was just like,
okay,
no,
nope.
But Scandal, I don't know. See, my reaction to Batman is different because I saw it, you know, a few years after it had come out and everything. But to me, like, as someone who was not like really tuned into pop culture at the time, like, that movie more than any other movie represents that time period, and the Prince music is just a part of it. And hearing Scandalous there, I mean, I love that. I love Kiss from a Rose at the end of Batman Forever. You know, the one which doesn't work for me is that weird jazz love song that they put at the end of Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
Yeah, you're right. Okay.
I don't know what that is, but yeah, but I can totally get down with. In fact, I was just looking for Scandalous the other day.
No, Scandalous was all wrong because it, like, you even had the reprise of the theme where, you know, little 13-year-old went, William Hootkins, he was Portkins when his credit came up and everything. And then it faded out, and it was like, for like the back end technical people, was like when Scandalous was playing. It was just, it was insulting. I was 13, and I was like, "No, come on, man! No, this isn't right."
No, I like that. I liked that. I have to say, I still love it. Still love it. I need to get that song on my iPod. I need to work on that. Anyway,
right.
Okay. So split decision on the song, I guess. Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with that. I mean, it seems so inappropriate. And there, I mean, here's another thing. Just thinking about the Oscars, it's like he won one Oscar for the score and one Oscar for that song. And it's like that score is such an integral part of that movie, and that movie being what it is, that it's like, yes, he should be rewarded for that for sure. And then he gets another one for this song, which is just kind of tacked on to the end. And it's like...
But as I recall, the song was woven in and worked into the score because of the extra 6 months.
Was it because of that? Okay.
Yeah. Like, the song wasn't going to make it. Mm-hmm. And then because they got the delay, they were able to flesh it out. Like, that's what I remember. It's probably a little more nuanced than that. But I'm fairly certain that it was the extra 6 months got that song into the movie.
Well, that makes sense. That's interesting. I mean, because you can definitely hear, like, the, you know, melodically speaking or whatever, the you can hear the song throughout the score,
yeah,
you know, which is really cool. But I guess the actual lyrics and stuff and hearing it, like, I don't know. Like, it's just weird to me that, you know, that's, I mean, I know it's for commercial reasons. It's the same reason why they honor, you know, four actors and one of everything else, but... It's just like, come on, that doesn't count, you know? I mean, it's so true. Like, they brought it up in the freaking Oscars, like when It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp won Best Song for Hustle and Flow, which is a great song, you know? And that, it does have, you know, a huge, you know, impact on that movie and everything. But, you know, Jon Stewart gets up there and he's like,
and made the joke that guaranteed he would never ever host the Oscars again.
Yeah. 3-6 Mafia 1, Martin Scorsese 0. And I mean, that's true. You know, Eminem has an Oscar, you know. I don't think Celine Dion got an Oscar for this. I don't think she wrote it, right? But
no, she didn't write it. But he did share the credit with William something.
Yeah, some other guy. Yeah, who we should probably acknowledge, but, you know.
Yeah, you know.
Whatever.
He's no James Horner.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, let's take a look at some of the other things that Horner did throughout his career, because Titanic and Star Trek are by no means the only things that he did throughout his career. So, what are some of your favorites? Like, what's a big one for you?
Aliens.
All right.
I mean, yes, Aliens, he winds up. And I was thinking about this as I was re-listening to it. One of the heaviest charges leveled against Horner is that he reuses certain cues. He'll borrow a couple of bars from himself.
Yeah, or other people.
But, yeah, well, you know, I mean, Williams, come on, Holst's
That's
the
true.
Planets basically, you know, was Star Wars.
Yeah.
But, you know, and he winds up, like, there are certain parts where if you just have aliens playing in the background, you'll think you're listening to Star Trek II.
Mm-hmm. Or
Patriot
Games.
Yeah.
Or 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah. But it still fits. It still works with the movie. And the overall themes are really good. I really like the Aliens score. Yes, he borrows stuff, but, you know, I'm not rushing to his defense, but at the same time, you know, artists like to rely on the same tricks or the same brushstroke or whatever when they're composing something. And so if he borrows a transition here or there, that's no more awful than John Williams borrowing some transitional cues for some stuff in Return of the Jedi. He borrowed from Superman for so, but it was none of the major themes. It was just some of the transitions between themes. It's like that's okay. Aliens is really, you know, it's really martial. It's really fun to listen to, and so I really like it.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem with him reusing stuff from his other scores. I mean, if something works, you know, go for it. Do it again, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, filmmakers do that all the time, you know? I mean, Spielberg, right? Spielberg used the same joke in 1941 in Raiders of the Lost Ark, right?
Oh, nobody talks about 1941 anymore. What's that? What?
Yeah, you know, 1941 sucks, but the behind-the-scenes footage that Robert Zemeckis shot for 1941... really cool. So
I'll have to see it.
Check that out. Yeah,
I will.
It's on the DVD at least, but
okay.
It's pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, Aliens, I would agree, you know, that's a pretty big one for me. And, you know, I think it's kind of cool that he did what he did with Wrath of Khan, which is not try to rehash what Goldsmith did with Alien, but instead, you know, make it a different thing, because Aliens was a different thing, you know.
Totally.
So it's really cool, I think, that he, you know, adapted the music to be something different as well. And that's a really strong one. For me, a really big one is Apollo 13.
Sure.
That's a movie which, you know, every time I watch it, I think, like, why is this not part of, you know, the canon, for lack of a better, you know, word? Why is this not one of the movies which we refer to as the greatest of all time? Because to me, it should be. You know, it's so well made, and a big part of that again is the score. I mean, you think about the launch sequence, you know, which is kind of like the centerpiece, and then the way that transitions into. What's going on, like, up in space, like, in the same piece, and sort of becoming this thing where it's, like, it goes from, like, spectacle to kind of, like, wonder. And then, of course, you've got, you know, sort of the thrust of the film, which is basically, like, the biggest suspense movie you've ever seen, you know?
Yeah.
Where, I mean, there's no bad guys or anything like that. There's no one chasing you with a gun, but the clock is chasing you, and... It's so intense, and he does such a good job with it. You know, I mean, that's a big one for me, is Apollo 13.
I totally agree, and I think that Apollo 13 is, for my money, is Ron Howard's best movie.
Yeah.
And it was also the unfortunate victim of being released in a really strong year for film.
Yeah.
You know, it came out at the same time as, like, Pulp Fiction and Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah,
and it's like, good luck getting noticed when those two movies are out there. I mean, good grief.
Well, yeah, I mean, I always thought it was crazy that year. Like, I think it got nominated for Best Picture, but Ron Howard didn't get nominated for Best Director. And my whole thing is, like, he took his actors up into space. You know?
Yeah.
What more could you want?
Yeah.
But you know, the movie that did win Best Picture that year. Was an interesting one, and that was Braveheart.
Well, Braveheart was 95, and right. Braveheart was a great score. I know that you haven't seen Braveheart still.
No.
Shame on you.
I'll watch it.
It's a great score. It really is, and I think that what you said about Titanic very much applies to the music in this movie, where, again, you can hear him borrow some of his own, you know, transitional bars, you know, here and there. But it is, the music complements everything that happens on screen so well, so perfectly, that listening to it, I can literally relive the movie.
Yeah.
And I adore Braveheart. So anything that helps me relive the movie is a fantastic thing. I mean, honestly, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, James Cameron composed the scores for two movies that made me cry like a child by the end of them. So, like, hats off to him, because the music definitely has something to do with moving somebody in that way. Yeah. Braveheart and Titanic, both, you know, waterworks for those movies. And so, yeah, man, like, the score for that is fantastic.
Yeah, James Horner, not James Cameron.
Oh, sorry, James Horner.
Yes.
I misspoke.
Everyone knew what you were talking about, so it's yeah. All good.
So, my bad.
Yeah, I'll watch Braveheart eventually. Yeah, I will. Yeah. I promise.
You are just going to keep torturing me with this. You really are.
But
the thing is, you're going to watch it. I just know what's going to happen. Like, I almost don't want you to watch it now, because you're going to watch it. You'll be like, yeah, it was okay. And at that point, I'm going to manage to come through the connection on the internet and destroy you.
No, I was just actually thinking about you because someone on Twitter who I follow literally did just that. He's like, I've never seen Braveheart. I think I'm going to watch it tonight. And then he was kind of like live tweeting it, I guess, or whatever. And he got to the end and he's like, very solid movie. Way too long. Has some problems. But on the whole, very good. And I'm like, that's going to be my reaction, I know.
Probably so.
Yeah. I mean, whatever. Mel Gibson, he's got some issues as far as filmmaking is concerned, as far as I'm concerned with his filmmaking. But, you know, whatever. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Not a huge Randall Wallace fan either, I have to say.
Why? Yeah.
Well, let's see. There was Pearl Harbor, which he wrote.
Oh, no.
Which, as much as I like Pearl Harbor, I thought the script was terrible. So
Pearl Harbor was the movie that's the one that I think you could very easily level the criticism that you were saying people were leveling against Titanic, where the first hour and a half, you just didn't care. But then the action in the back half of it is so good that, like, you stayed and watched the rest of it.
Yeah. Pearl Harbor, I like. I mean, I think mainly it's the photography which gets me. I think the photography is outstanding in that movie. But whatever. Mm. Oh. Randall Wallace also directed Secretariat and Heaven is for Real. Interesting.
Secretariat was very underwhelming.
I didn't
see that
one.
The book is fantastic. I can't recommend the book highly enough.
Yeah.
And I believe the same author wrote Unbroken. And that's a book that is I'm not even going to bother seeing the movie, because there's no way a movie can interpret or equal that book in any stretch of the imagination.
Coen Brothers, though.
No.
No? Okay.
No.
All right. Fair enough. I'm probably not going to watch Unbroken either, unless I have to.
No, there's no need. But back to Horner.
Horner,
you know,
yeah.
Another score for you that works.
Another score for me that works. How many have you had so far? Well, you did Aliens, and I forced you into Braveheart.
You tricked me into Braveheart.
Yeah.
Just like Braveheart tricked the English into that trap halfway through the movie.
Well, another Horner score for me, I guess, would be, you know, I don't know. I mean, because we talked about Aliens. I mean, there's some.
You're overlooking one of his best.
You're going to say The Rocketeer.
No.
No. What?
Willow.
Oh, I don't even remember that. I watched it once, man. And I was just like,
Willow is a great, fun score, and it is, it's tremendous work. Like, it's Horner doing his John Williams bit, because Willow is Ron Howard doing his George Lucas bit.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really is. But it works. It's so much fun. And the theme that he came up with and the soundtrack that exists for Willow it conveys that sense of just sort of childish, for lack of a better term, that sort of childish what the hell that Ron Howard sort of puts the movie together with, where it's just like, you know, let's just have some fun and not worry about the bigger themes or anything like that. Let's just sit down and have a good time. And the score very much supports that.
Okay. All right. Have you got any others?
No, that would tap me out for Horner.
All right. All right. Well, you know, I mean, not that this is one of his best or anything like that, but one which is noteworthy in that it just came out a couple weeks ago is Southpaw, which is essentially his last, although, you know, there's a few other things which are still going to be released. But Southpaw is the new movie by Antoine Fuqua, who is one of my favorite filmmakers. And, it's written by the guy, Kurt Suter, who created Sons of Anarchy. And it's
Sutter.
About... What was that?
Sutter.
Sutter?
Okay. Yeah.
There you go. Shows you how much I know. It's basically about a guy who's a boxer, a champion, you know, world champion, and, you know, some crazy stuff happens, and his life ends up falling apart, like, in a big, bad way, and it's about him trying to piece it back together. And it's a really solid movie. I would definitely recommend it. And it's interesting, like, I was listening to the score, because it's on, you know, Apple Music and everything. I was listening to it earlier today or yesterday, and it's very different from Horner's other scores, in one sense, because it feels a lot more modern, in a way. You know, I don't know if that makes any sense. Like, maybe a lot of it, I mean, he's really good at sort of adapting to the material, like you were saying, like the militaristic quality of Aliens. If you listen to the Avatar score, it's very sort of like almost, I want to say, like kind of like tribal, you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
But with Southpaw, it's very sort of, I mean, the only thing that I can think of is sort of like modern, you know? Mm-hmm. And it has this sort of street, you know, mentality to it, you know, which I think is very much present in the movie. It's about a guy who grew up, you know, like in the foster care system and everything like that, and sort of rose to fame and everything, but never lost that side of his personality. You know, he was always, still stuck in his past in one way or another. And, the score reflects that, and the other thing which I found to be rather interesting about it is, unlike stuff like Titanic, where it's very much sort of movie-driven, like scene-driven and everything, and complementing like exactly what is on screen, this was more like mood music. Like, I'm listening to the score, you know, track by track, and each track I'm like, this sounds exactly the same. It's much more just sort of like this thematic stuff, which is running through like underneath the scenes instead of like engaging with them, which was an interesting style, you know, and I think appropriate to the piece. But there were no moments where it stood out for me, and I'm just like, oh, this is great. Like we were talking about with like the music weaving, or the song, you know, My Heart Will Go On, like weaving in and out of the score. You know, there's nothing like that going on. It was very much sort of a more subdued score. And it, you know, taking that philosophy, I think, is interesting, because it I think will be easier to apply what he's written for Magnificent Seven to the actual movie, which, you know, same director and everything. You know, we talked about last week how, you know, he's written stuff for that movie, or he had written before he passed away. And I'm sure, I mean, I how could they not incorporate that stuff into the movie, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, just for the tugging at the heartstrings alone, be like, James Horner wrote this before he died.
Right.
For your consideration.
And you know, it's the type of thing where I wouldn't be at all surprised if they bring in like another person to fill it out, you know.
Sure.
But it's going to be based on those themes, just like someone who's doing a new Star Wars movie will always use John Williams' themes, you know. So I mean that's kind of interesting to me, and I think that it could make for an interesting score for sure. And you know, in the hands of a filmmaker as skilled as Antoine Fuqua, I'm sure it'll be impressive. You know.
Yeah.
So that's that. And any final thoughts on Horner's career?
Yeah, you know, he's never. I don't think in geek circles he'll ever get quite the same respect as, say, a John Williams. But he will always be able to hang his hat, or would have been able to hang his hat, however you want to phrase it, on Star Trek II and Aliens, which are two of, you know, even if you don't consider them two of the finest movies you've ever seen, they're definitely two of the best, you know, sci-fi movies that have ever been created. But, you know, he definitely made his mark, you know, and at the very least with Titanic. I mean, Titanic and Braveheart, you know, they're what, 2 years separated, and they've got, they're so epic and they're so indelible that you can't deny the guy's contribution to, you know, the filmmaking scores in general.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, he isn't one of those names that stands out to me really in the list of the best composers of all time. You know, I mean, that is kind of reserved for Williams and Goldsmith, and you know, throw in John Bryan there as a wild card. But he is my absolute favorite. I'm sorry,
Hans Zimmer.
There you go. But you know, the stuff that he did speaks for itself, and it's one of those things like Apollo 13, for example. You know, where while you may not think about it off the top of your head, when you do take the time to analyze it, his career, you do realize that, like, the stuff that he did was legendary, and it's part of not only the film landscape, but, you know, the cultural landscape in general, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, sure. I mean, just talking about how My Heart Will Go On was everywhere to the point of, you know... You know, I mean, the rage that it induced, I mean, that says something,
yeah.
You know? I mean, yeah. You can only hope that you have that impact on society, you know?
Yeah.
It means you're doing something right, so.
Yeah. Hopefully this show at some point will inspire rage on that scale. I think we can do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think while maybe the rage won't be as widespread, I think it could be as intense, you know?
Easily.
You know?
White hot, like starfire.
Right, exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly, even though if it's like a very little contained flame, you know?
Oh, a white dwarf will still burn you.
Yeah. So,
still burn you.
So we'll try to do that. We'll try to enrage you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. It's good to be enraged. Well, it's been good talking about James Horner's career today, but that's not the only thing we're talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I'm just like, wait a second. Wait, no. They wouldn't do that. Would they do that? No, they wouldn't do that. And then, like, they did the whole scene again, and I was like, what? Ah!
Earl Grey.
Yeah, really, she's following the Hasbrat, I think, is really what it is.
Come for the revolution, stay for the Hasbrat.
It's got to be fresh Hasbrat. None of that replicated.
Like, Daniel's like, at the watching the end of this episode, like, tears are coming down the face. It's like, no, it's the Hasbrat. It's so spicy. It's what it is.
The Orb.
Also, the original title of this episode was A Matter of Breeding, which, when we talk about things feeling TNG-ish, that could have been a Riker episode.
The Ready Room.
It's about people and feelings and emotions. It's about philosophy. It's about the future. It's about hope. It's about glory. It's about intellectual promise. That's what Axanar is about. It is not a story about pew, pew, pew. I promise you that.
To the journey!
There's flamethrowers and cannibalism, and yet he's saying it's a big snore. Warp 5.
It kind of like is akin to when fans saw the Galaxy class in The Next Generation for the very first time, and you had basically a crew and civilian complement of, what, over 1,000 people. About 2/3 of that complement were civilians and their families. So you actually did have teachers and scholars and scientists and their extended families on board.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
But you would never pick up on that based on the way that it plays out, aside from the fact that they explicitly tell you in the dialogue, you know?
The 602 Club.
Yeah, I mean, it's about growth. It's about taking a character that has problems and flaws and becoming a better person. You can say that about lots of movies.
Literary Treks.
Deep Space Nine, among all the Star Trek series, is the one that really, over time, and I'm talking about now on the television series, not just in the books, changed the most.
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, it had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Women at Warp.
I like the episode. I don't love the Riker.
I don't love the Riker.
The Riker of it all?
I'm sorry. Is there an Enterprise lady, a regular Enterprise lady, that Riker does not bone?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. You know, also leave us a review because that apparently helps us out too. And we like reviews and we'll read them on the air. So tell us why you agree with us or disagree with us. Tell us what you think James Horner's best score is and what you think about My Heart Will Go On. And
We'll even read it in a phony British accent if you want.
Sure.
Just say it.
Sure, yeah. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 files from our website and grab the RSS link there as well. Another way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on Trek.fm. Just go to Trek.fm/contact. You can also leave us a voicemail. Just look on the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find the network on Twitter at Trek.fm, and you can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Also on Facebook, you can find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field. On Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. So where can people find you, John?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, where I do not confuse the names James Horner and James Cameron. And you can also find me on a weekly podcast called Words with Nerds that airs every Thursday with my buddy Craig.
All right, and you can find me right here on Trek FM doing Standard Orbit with Drew, or you can find me on my website, commentarytrackstars.com, where I do commentary track stars off topic and commentary track star babies, where you can find a commentary for Titanic, which was actually, you know, not a bad one, if I do say so myself. You know, some of our commentaries were pretty crappy, but Titanic, I think was rather solid. We broke it up into two parts so as not to overwhelm, and go check it out for sure. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, or you can find the show on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. All right. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor who helps us bring commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Do you have a book for us this week, John?
I do have a book for us this week. It's called Titanic, Voices from the Disaster by Deborah Hopkinson. Scheduled to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the tragic sinking of the Titanic, a topic that continues to haunt and thrill listeners to this day, this audiobook by critically acclaimed author Deborah Hopkinson weaves together the voices and stories of real Titanic survivors and witnesses to the disaster, from the stewardess Violet Jessop to Captain Arthur Rostron of the Carpathia, who came to the rescue of the sinking ship, packed with heart-stopping action, devastating drama, and more.
And you can get this book for free since you listen to Trek FM. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for supporting commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. Well, that's it for James Horner. And next week, we're going to sort of segue into some more composers and whatnot, or one more composer and whatnot. And we're going to take a look at the guy who preceded James Horner, Jerry Goldsmith.